What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. In Lagos, I'm Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Did any of you watch The Last of Us, the 2023 post-apocalyptic series about that deadly viral plague? The highly acclaimed show was in fact an adaptation of a video game. Our correspondent explains why this is becoming a more common path for Hollywood's directors. And how the world has fallen in love with romanticy, the literary love child of fantasy and romance. It turns out that lust and a dash of fairy dust make the perfect recipe for a TikTok bestseller. But first, there were celebrations in Gaza last night with news that Hamas had accepted the terms of a ceasefire agreement. In the city of Rafah, in the southern part of the strip, crowds of Palestinians cheered. But those celebrations proved premature. And soon after, Israeli missiles hit the eastern part of the city. This morning, Israeli tanks took control of the border crossing at Rafah, one of the two entry points for aid into the strip. Though a ceasefire feels closer, for now, the fighting in Gaza continues.
It was a roller coaster weekend. On Saturday morning, there was a lot of optimism that Israel and Hamas were close to a ceasefire deal.
Greg Karlstrom is a Middle East correspondent for The Economist.
By Monday morning, that optimism had soured and the talks seemed like they were close to collapse. And then on Monday night, very unexpectedly, Hamas announced that it had agreed to a ceasefire. It's still not clear, though, whether or not Israel will accept.
So, Greg, tell us about the deal. What might it look like?
I should say we're not 100% sure what it looks like at this point. We're all trying to work off of leaks, but nothing has been published publicly. But what we know of the earlier proposal for a ceasefire, this is an Egyptian proposal put forward several weeks ago that Israel had already accepted. That called for a three-phase ceasefire. So there would be an initial stage lasting 6 weeks in which Hamas would release 33 Israeli hostages who were being held in Gaza. Israel would release hundreds of Palestinian prisoners in exchange. Then there would be a second phase where there could be additional hostages released, and there would be talks about what the agreement called a sustainable calm in Gaza. And then there was a hoped for third phase in which there would be a sustainable calm implemented, and there would be an exchange of bodies and a longer term ceasefire in Gaza. I think the question right now that everyone has is this text that Hamas put forward on Monday night, how close it is to the original version, the Egyptian proposal that Israel agreed to earlier in these negotiations. It looks like, from what I've heard so far, there are some differences between the two. To give you one example, the Egyptian proposal had called on Hamas to release these 33 hostages in groups of three hostages every 3 days. What Hamas has agreed to is to release three hostages per week, each week for 6 weeks until the final week of this first phase, and then it would release the balance of the 33 hostages. So there are some substantive differences between the two, but the question is whether or not those differences are so significant that Israel might view them as deal breakers.
Greg, what has Israel said about the deal?
There was a meeting of the War Cabinet on Monday night, and the statement that came out from Prime Minister Netanyahu's office after that meeting described the Hamas text as far from what Israel demanded. But at the same time, the War Cabinet unanimously agreed to send a low-level delegation to Cairo for further negotiations about the text. There's been some pressure overnight. There were protests in Israel, some of them including the families of the hostages who were being held in Gaza, and they were trying to put pressure on the Israeli government to agree to a deal and secure the release of at least some of those hostages.
So what does this mean for the war itself?
For today, it means nothing has changed. On Monday, Israel began its offensive in Rafah, in the southernmost city in Gaza. It dropped leaflets on part of Rafah, telling about 100,000 Palestinians, civilians who have been sheltering there, who have been displaced there, telling them to evacuate and move to a different part of southern Gaza. There was bombardment in Rafah on Monday, and then on Tuesday morning, there were reports of Israeli tanks moving into the southernmost part of Rafah. This is along the border between Egypt and Gaza. A column of Israeli tanks advanced along the border. They have now reached and taken control of the Rafah border crossing between Egypt and Gaza, which has been the main conduit for humanitarian aid going into Gaza throughout the war. It's also been the only border crossing that a limited number of Palestinians in Gaza have been able to use to get out of Gaza and get into Egypt. So that crossing now in Israeli hands, and it's not clear what that means for both the flow of humanitarian aid in and the flow of civilians out. The War Cabinet, after its meeting Monday night, said that it had voted unanimously in favor of continuing the offensive in Rafah. And so I think while these talks are going on in Cairo, in parallel to that, there is going to be ongoing fighting in and around the city.
Where does America stand on all this?
President Biden had a call with Prime Minister Netanyahu on Monday night. This was shortly before Hamas announced that it had accepted a ceasefire. And the call lasted about half an hour and ended with a readout from the White House saying that the president had reiterated his clear position on Rafah to Netanyahu. Now, that position for months has been that America is not completely opposed to the idea of an offensive in the city, but it is opposed to an offensive without adequate provisions for evacuating the civilian population, protecting the civilian population. And those provisions really have not been made. There just is not adequate infrastructure set up elsewhere to take care of 1.5 million people. So in practice, the Americans don't want to see this offensive go forward right now. And that is why they have been desperate in recent weeks to try and broker a ceasefire deal. There have been some reports in the past couple of days that America has also delayed deliveries of weapons that Israel purchased from arms manufacturers in the U.S. The Pentagon has denied this. It says that everything is business as usual. But if those reports are accurate, I think it's a shot across the bow from the Americans. It's sending a message to Israel that the Americans are opposed to this offensive and that perhaps more such punitive measures could follow if Israel goes ahead with what could be a very bloody offensive in Rafah.
Greg, what happens next?
I think we've all learned over the past 7 months to be a bit cautious about answering that question. We have to wait and see just how big the gaps are again between the earlier proposal that Israel had agreed to and then the later version that Hamas agreed to. And if Israel thinks it can work with, it can negotiate those differences, then there will be a period of days, perhaps a couple of weeks, where they have some back and forth discussions. And then the question is whether the Israeli government actually wants to make a deal or not. Prime Minister Netanyahu, for months now, has been of two minds about whether he wants a ceasefire. He has been open to these talks. He has sent delegations to negotiate. He has expressed some willingness to make a deal, but he's also very worried about what that means in terms of Israeli domestic politics, because his right-wing coalition partners do not want him to make a deal that would pause the war for an extended period of time, that would prevent Israel from going ahead with its incursion in Rafah. And they were very clear in recent days that if Netanyahu made such a deal, they would leave the coalition, bring down the government. That would probably force an early election, and Netanyahu would probably lose that early election. So he's been hoping, I think, that Hamas would be the one to reject these ceasefire deals, which it has done in the past. But now that Hamas has accepted a deal, it has really put the ball in Netanyahu's court, where he has to make a decision that he has tried for so long to avoid making.
Greg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
There's a new installment of Fallout, the series of video games, and it's received rave reviews.
Now, I acknowledge that I'm unfamiliar with your circumstances, but at first glance, your treatment of this man appears unfair, and I'm obliged to intervene.
The post-apocalyptic adventure, released in April, has been hailed as a rare gem and an absolute blast by critics. However, the difference with this latest release is that it's not a video game. It's a TV series.
Stand down. Or be cut down.
There was a time when turning games into live-action narratives was tricky for Hollywood scriptwriters.
Tom Wainwright is our media editor.
But now studios are finding commercial and critical success. The Super Mario Bros. Movie, released in 2023, was the second highest-grossing film at the worldwide box office that year.
Aww. He looks adorable!
He really does.
Then there's The Last of Us, also released in 2023, a TV show based on a PlayStation game.
Fungi seem harmless enough.
Many species know otherwise, because there are some fungi who seek not to kill, but to control.
That won a stack of Emmys in January, and more game adaptations are on the way. Hollywood's favourite source of material, comic books, is getting boring. For more than two decades, the box office has been ruled by superheroes. But more recently, each Marvel film has seemed to be less successful and less lauded than the one before it. The Marvels, released in November, was the lowest grossing one so far. Game adaptations, though, offer an alternative. There are already lots of pre-existing storylines, plus an audience that's already there. Amazon Prime Video and Netflix have been pioneers of the gaming adaptation, partly because, unlike older studios, they have a limited archive of intellectual property. The success of Castlevania in 2017 and The Witcher in 2019, both gaming adaptations on Netflix, got the attention of the other Hollywood studios. There are also changes within the gaming world which have contributed to this evolution. For one thing, more people play games now. Smartphones mean that everyone has a miniature gaming console in their pocket. Meanwhile, the COVID-19 pandemic created millions of new gamers through sheer boredom. This popularity provides a large potential audience for film spin-offs. Titles such as Minecraft are played by more than 100 million people each month. It's also easier now to get video game-themed projects greenlit in Hollywood. Previous generations of producers were a bit befuddled by games, but the current generation grew up playing them. There's also a sense that more modern games are just better candidates for adaptation than the games of the past. Amazon's Fallout has a sharp script and a strong cast, but its epic post-apocalyptic setting, its twisting plot, and its rich backstory all come from the video game. The PlayStation version of The Last of Us, released in 2013, was so cinematic that the opening scenes of the TV adaptation, released 10 years later, were barely changed.
Where'd you get the money for this?
Drugs. I sell hardcore drugs.
It's better when I do.
The show was able to borrow lots of dialogue from the game, as the central characters were so vividly drawn. However, for all the recent hits, game adaptations are not yet such reliable performers as superheroes. Paramount's Halo and Netflix's Resident Evil, for instance, didn't live up to expectations. One analyst told me the biggest hits tend to be either so well known that even non-gamers recognise the brand, so think Mario, Sonic, or Angry Birds, or so engaging that the fact that they began as video games doesn't matter, which could apply to the likes of The Last of Us or Fallout. One way or another, it seems that this is just the beginning for games on screen.
Perhaps it is Frodo's hairy feet. Perhaps it is because orcs are not that erotic. Perhaps it is because too many characters sing songs containing words like medio and deedle-dum-diddle.
Catherine Nixie is a Britain correspondent for The Economist.
Whatever the reason, one thing is clear. The Lord of the Rings is rarely considered an erotic romp. Fantasy books generally aren't. Harry Potter is a child. Aslan is an animal. And while books by writers such as Ursula Le Guin do contain sex, they also contain phrases in the hormonal secretion is further stimulated vein, which rarely set pulses racing. One exception is Game of Thrones, which does contain lashings of sex, but since it also contains lashings of lashings, not to mention phrases such as beat her bloody, it's not usually considered romantic.
You have a woman's body now.
But fantasy is changing, because romanticy, the literary love child of fantasy and romance, has arrived. It offers fornicating fairies, dragons that smoulder in more ways than one, and magic with a whiff of Mills and Boone. Romanticy is a frankly alarming portmanteau, and at times, a mildly alarming read. Feminism, it turns out, is not a forte in fairyland. Male fairies can be domineering, violent, have hands like shackles, which they use to pin women down. Perhaps even more troublingly, in romanticy, the word fairy is frequently spelt fairy, which is fairly irritating. But that hardly matters because romanticy is so very successful. Sarah J. Maas has sold over 38 million books. Another romanticy author, Rebecca Yarros, sold a record-breaking 57,000 books in a single month in Britain last year. Dragons are hot. This genre should not feel surprising. The 20th century might have unsexed the supernatural, but the genre was not always so chaste. There was originally far more romance in fantasy than is often remembered. In the original version of Rapunzel, the prince doesn't merely drop by the tower to say hello to Rapunzel, but has sex with her while she's locked in there. In Arthurian legend, another influence of fantasy, King Arthur, somewhat Game of Thrones-ishly, commits incest with his half-sister. The chastity of much of modern fantasy seems to have been partly an accident of the age. British obscenity laws could be restrictive. The last of the Lord of the Rings trilogy was published in 1955. 5 years later, the Lady Chatterley trial took place. Ever since Harry Potter, many best-selling fantasy books have been aimed at children and young adults. But that's changing. The generation who grew up reading Harry Potter and other young adult fantasy books are now actual adults who are still interested in one kind of fantasy, but also now in another. These books give them both. One of the most popular series is set in a dragon rider's military training college. Imagine Hogwarts, but with hotter, older students. Muscles ripple, sexual preferences are fluid, everyone is having a lot of sex, and talking about it in the sort of terms that would have Professor McGonagall putting them all in detention. Two characters have sex that is so good that it results in actual thunderbolts. The adult world is like that. But while in one way these books inhabit an adult world, in another they are in full flight from it. Characters have names such as Zayden and Azrael rather than Clive or Simon. They all spend a lot of time defeating evil, very little time filling in tax returns or taking the bins out. And at other times, fantasy's enthusiasm for exposition makes some of the characters feel less adult than actively aged, as like visitors in an old people's home. They seem to spend a lot of time reminding each other about important details of their own lives. "You fought at Strithy Moor," one character tells another helpfully, as you might tell an elderly relative in an old people's home. If the fantasy element of these books is more or less what you'd expect, the romance is arguably not. These books are being read by a generation who came of age after Me Too. This is a generation that is encouraged to commence consensual seduction by the use of such phrases as, "I'd like to have sex tonight, would you?" and "What do you want to do or try tonight?" and "May I?" which sounds less like someone offering a night of passion than someone offering to open a door. Suffice to say, however, fairies don't waste much time saying, "May I?" And so, on perturbed online forums, romantasy readers debate the problematic nature of non-consensual sex in fairyland, offering trigger warnings as they do so. Fairy-sex might, for some, seem fairly problematic, but it is also very profitable. So whatever its problems, romantasy is likely to continue to seduce.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think of the show. You can drop us a line at podcast@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.